Welcome to the 2018 Bay Area Book Festival. This is Sherilyn Parsons, founder and director of the festival. Enjoy the conversation.
Hi, everybody. Welcome. So happy to have you here, and we're going to start on time because it's a chock-full day. There are 100 things I want to go to even right now, but I'm happy to be here, and about 14 things I want to go to after this. So welcome to everybody. Thanks so much for coming today. I'm Barbara Lane, and I have the pleasure of moderating this panel, which is so timely and four incredibly great books. So if you haven't read them yet, you should. And I encourage you to buy them following today's program in the lobby outside, and our fabulous authors will be signing them. So please do. The more books in people's hands, the better. So if you haven't already silenced your cell phone or pager, please take a moment and do so now. And this session is called Beyond Jane and Hermione, and I just want to say that one of the greatest things about this festival is running into other writers. I ran into a wonderful writer this morning who I hadn't met before, Hernan Diaz, who, although he's Argentinian, grew up in Sweden, and we talked about Pippi Longstocking. So that's what happens here, and in terms of strong characters, Pippi's one of my favorite. But anyway, with us today, starting from the end, we have, and please, if I mispronounce your name or butcher it, correct me, Yana Casale. And Yana Casale, starting here. So I did the first thing wrong, because that's Azarine. Yana Casale, and her first book is a novel, The Girl Who Never Read Noam Chomsky. What a title. I love that. I never read Noam Chomsky. And Martha Batalha, is that correct? And her first novel is The Invisible Life of Eurydice Guzmão?
Yes.
And Adrienne Sharp, her new novel is called The Magnificent Esme Wells. She's also written the novels The Sleeping Beauty and The True Memoirs of Little Kay, and a story collection, White Swan, Black Swan. And at the end, Azarine van der Vliet Olumi, and her first novel was Frau Keeler. The book she's with here today is called Call Me Zebra. So before we begin, some of you perhaps have read one or more of these novels. Many of you have not, so I've asked our writers assembled here today to do the impossible, which is just take a moment and briefly and succinctly sum up their novels, so as we get into the conversation, you have an idea where they're coming from in terms of the wonderful fictional worlds they've created. So we'll start with Yana.
Hi, guys. So my book's called The Girl Who Never Read Noam Chomsky, and it's about a girl who never read Noam Chomsky. It starts with her in college deciding she'd like to read a book by Noam Chomsky, and then chronicles the entirety of the rest of her life, where she never does. So that's literally what it is about. But it's really about womanhood and celebrating the joys of womanhood and discussing the challenges of womanhood. Pieced out in everyday moments of life, so each chapter is a tiny little moment that make up her life and talks about dreams and who we are and who we want to be and where we go in life.
Hello. So my book is The Invisible Life of Eurydice Guzmão, and it's basically the story of two sisters who grows up in Rio de Janeiro in the 40s and 50s, and how hard it is for them to have a fulfilling life, because they can't dream of having jobs or having some sort of art career. They just have to have that family kind of life. And it's basically it's a book that talks a lot about how was life in Rio at that time. And one of the main themes is chauvinism, and it was very funny to show in the book how ridiculous it is. So basically it's about that.
Hello. So my novel is The Magnificent Esme Wells, and it's the story of a young girl whose parents are both gorgeous and reckless, and who drag her all around 1939 Los Angeles, going to sound stages and to racetracks. And eventually, Esme and her father end up in the nascent Las Vegas as the strip is being built. And this is a landscape she finds she can navigate more successfully than her father. And she becomes his protector while she's dancing at the Flamingo and the Desert Inn and ultimately at the Stardust until things fall apart.
Hi, everyone. Thanks for being here. My novel is Call Me Zebra, and it follows the story of a young Iranian woman who comes from a long lineage of anarchists, autodidacts, and atheists, and she eventually ends up in New York City. When her father passes away, she decides that she's going to retrace the path of their exile back through Barcelona and to Turkey, and isn't actually ever able to complete the journey because she falls in love with an Italian philologist who's an expat living in Catalonia, and they have a very strange love affair, and he tries to kind of rescue her from her very bookish life unsuccessfully.
So as I'm listening to these authors describe their books in Vegas, in Rio, an Italian philologist, we're all over the place, and that's great. We're also here right now. This is so timely because, of course, we're in this Me Too moment. And in the car on the way over here, I heard Ronan Farrow, who just won the Pulitzer for his reporting on Harvey Weinstein. We all know, unless you've been living under a rock, that this week Bill Cosby was convicted. So this stuff, strong women, women speaking out, is certainly of the moment. And although you were writing your books before this story broke, we have to acknowledge Me Too. And I'm curious what kind of change, if any, you think that's going to make, specifically in the literary world, and just any reflections you might have on that. Anybody?
As you said, this happened, you know, writing the novel was quite a ways before this happened, but I do remember when the election happened, just feeling this sense of, you know, just devastation in a way, because I knew my book was coming out the next year, and about a year and a half from then, and I thought, does it even matter to be saying these things anymore if this is where we're at? But, you know, now I think it's great to see women coming to a point where they feel that they can speak for themselves from who they are as individuals. You know, that's the challenge that we really face with all of it, which is hearing a voice of an individual person without a label of anything else beyond that. That's a challenge for, you know, every group of a person that's marginalized in our society. But I think especially for women, that is very hard for us a lot of times, to feel that we can really tap into that authenticity. And I know in my book I talk a lot about identity and that challenge for my main character, Alita, who, you know, she's a feminist and she has this all this ideology that she, you know, believes in, and yet she can't get over the fact that she goes to a coffee shop and if a guy gives her a little attention, it makes her feel good about herself. It gives her confidence. And what does that say about her? And what does that say about her life? And, you know, so we all struggle with that, I think, finding out who exactly we are. And as far as literature moving forward in this place, it's hard to say that kind of thing because, you know, you want to believe that, I do believe there will be more authors speaking out and feeling that they can really tap into that truest self in their work. But it also, I think all of us probably feel some level of trepidation in a sense of wondering what this really means as far as moving forward. It's so early in it, you know, there's no going back, and yet it's hard to say what will be going forward and how much of a change things will really be, you know?
I want to follow up with everybody else, but since you brought up your character's concern with how she looks, no matter how liberated we are, the characters are, that's often a concern. I happened to hear a little bit of Janine Roth this morning, and of course, she speaks about that. So can you just talk about that a little and her sort of combination of liberated and oppressed, much by her own insecurities and a lot by her body?
Yeah, I talk a lot about body image in the book and kind of her struggle all the time with wanting to be thinner. She calls it linearity, and she's always trying to be more linear. And yeah. Which I actually, that someone one summer, I had lost some weight, and a friend of mine was like, oh, you lost weight. And I was like, oh, thanks. And she's like, not that you were that different before, but you just look more linear. And I thought, that's exactly what I'm trying to be. I didn't realize it till this moment, but that's what I'm going for. But you know, body image issues, I think as women, we all struggle with this, and yet we feel a sense of shame over it because we feel that it's kind of trivial, it's vanity, it's not something we should, you know, focus on. So we know it's not right, that it shouldn't be a part of our lives, and yet it so is. And I remember when I was editing the book, I went back and I wrote this chapter where she goes to try on bathing suits, and it's hell, as trying on bathing suits is. And I was like, oh, am I pushing this too far? Is this going to become the body image issue book? But I realized that it's not trivial to hate your body your whole life. That's actually really devastating. This is our body. It's the only physical thing any person actually owns. And so that thought that, you know, you go through your whole life and you have this kind of struggle with yourself, your physical self in this way, you know, it does affect you on this really deep and immovable level, and to not give that credit and say, well, what does that mean? You know, the fact that we've been told to feel this way is actually serious and important. It's not just something to be cast aside.
So I'd love to have the rest of you jump in on Me Too. And Adrian, I know you trained as a ballet dancer and you've written about the ballet world, not in this particular novel. You might have some energy on this subject. So please jump in about Me Too and its effect.
Regarding the Me Too movement, I think it's important, and it's, of course, like relationships in work are going to change. But I also think that's, for me that come from other culture, I feel that's like almost a local movement, because it's very hard to discuss these kinds of things in other countries. For instance, I come from a reality that the kind of feminist questions and issues that you're having, it's not like if you're going to have the same rights as a man in work, but it's if it's a girl, it's not going to get pregnant when she's 12. Or if she's going to be beaten by her father or brother or husband, how he's going to denounce it and to be safe. So I think that the feminist movement, it's also it's a discussion about first you have to address inequality in the world, because these are the things that's also important. So the Me Too, it's important. It's important here, but in other places, we are not there yet.
And in your novel, Martha, the two sisters who are very capable and very smart and they can do lots of extraordinary things. They are restrained by a very traditional patriarchal culture. Fundamental things, not insidious things, but things that are at the root of that culture.
Yes, yes. And it's funny because I wrote this book about this woman. They're just trying to, you know, have a life outside marriage, and they just can't because of cultural issues. And even today, I just came from a book tour in Brazil. I just launched my second book, and people come to me. A lot of women say, "You just wrote my life. You just wrote the life of my mother." And it's interesting because I wrote a book that it was in six. The story is 60 years ago, and people still have this struggle in Brazil today. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that's why I think that the feminist movement is something you have different levels, you know, in the world about that.
Adrian?
Well, I think in my worlds of Hollywood in Vegas, the exploitation of women would just be a given, and my character even reflects that. What does a woman in this time and place have to offer other than her face and her body? And my character decides to make as much money as she possibly can off those things, even while she's benefiting others. So she's working within the societal limitations of the time and ends up asking for a cut of the tables, because there's just a short while she can dance on the stage, and she recognizes by age 40, women are in support hose working in the coffee shop. So she's got 30 years or 25 years here to make some money and to use the men who are trying to use her in the same way.
This is a tough one for me to answer in light of my narrator, because she's so, I think, disembodied for most of the novel, and she kind of consumes literature and thinks about sentences as things that she can, like, you know, eat or chew on, and, you know, has a very kind of sensual and deep, passionate relationship to books. And she doesn't eat a lot, but it's not because of body image issues as much as it is just a deep trauma of having walked from Iran to Turkey through the Iran-Iraq War, and her mother dies early on in the novel while going into a ruined home to kind of scavenge for food. And, you know, she believes deep down that the only way she can survive as an exile in the world is through memorization and through reciting literature and keeping the memory of their story alive, and the memory of sort of the struggle of her people and people all over the world alive. And she has these various theories that she comes up with about the pyramid of exile and the matrix of literature. And I think that she has to confront her body through Ludo, who's, you know, all about... you know, he's like a bon vivant and all about eating and having sex, and she doesn't really quite know how to participate in that level of reality all the time. But about the Me Too movement, I think I would agree, you know, I'm someone who grew up in Iran and in Europe and in America, and it's... I think that I have a sort of patchy experience or relationship to the Me Too movement, just because there are so many... I have so many different cultures within me, and they often are very contradictory, or like you said, there are different levels of feminism operating within my consciousness simultaneously, and they don't always agree about or settle on the same plane. So, you know, I think, a wonderful thing that's happening. It's amplifying a conversation that's been there forever, and we just sort of need to acknowledge it and hopefully continue to acknowledge women's voices and the ways in which we can collaborate with one another and lean in at work and have that kind of relationship to ourselves, to our own intellect. Yeah.
Your character, Azarine, is described as a literary terrorist, which is a great phrase. Could you explain a little bit more about that and just give everybody here today sort of the flavor of how she lives in this literature?
Yeah, so she's kind of a child prodigy, and part of that is that her father is, you know, one of these sort of true intellectuals who believes he's part of the 0.1%, and he's very suspicious even of other intellectuals, and he recites literature to her from the moment she's born, and he also kind of recites a corrected history of Iran and a philosophy of time to her constantly. And it does take on, because it's so exaggerated, it takes on very, very humorous tones. But she's really reading a lot of the great books, as she's a big Nietzsche reader. And part of her project of understanding what her place is in the world is to do this kind of reading of the writers of exile, or what she calls the writers of the void, and she begins to develop a manifesto called The Matrix of Literature, where she's threading together all of these different writers' sentences and collects quotes, and that's the way that she knows how to perpetuate her life, right?
I have to ask you, Azarine, you've lived in many parts of the world, as you said, in Iran. I think you mentioned you lived in the Emirates. And I have to take the opportunity to ask you about your thoughts about what's going on today in Saudi Arabia, because it seems there's a crack opening a bit. And do you have your eye on that at all?
I mean, I hear about it, but I would be remiss to really... I can't have an opinion about it. It's just such a different world from Iran or the Emirates. So it would be, I think, a mistake for me to have a very kind of conclusive opinion about it. I do think it's a hopeful moment, but there's a long, long way to go. And, you know, when you open up a space like that, you don't know what else is going to shift in the fabric of those territories or that specific reality.
Right.
And so, you know, I am both hopeful and concerned. That's all I can really say.
So I want to ask a question, starting with Adrian, about the role of research in the work you did. Because, Adrian, you mentioned you're talking about Las Vegas, 1929. Tell us how you immersed yourself in that world, because there's some wonderful detail in your book. And for those of us who've grown up, seen some of the movies about early Las Vegas and Bugsy Siegel and Meyer Lansky and those guys, this book really makes it come alive for you. So can you talk about, and Martha, also your book is takes place in the 60s, is that right, I believe? So if you two and then anybody else could jump in and talk about the role of research.
Well, a part of it is I started going to Vegas with my husband in the 80s when what was left of old Vegas was still there, a little patched over, but before they started imploding all the buildings and creating these new monster-sized hotels there. And my first experience at the Flamingo was in the old part of the hotel where I kept making the bellman take me from one room to another to find something that I thought was suitable because there were these tiny postage stamp rooms with two little beds and a mid-century lamp. And then I finally realized this is what old Vegas was like. Garden apartments, very simple, nothing over the top. It sort of reflected just post-war America, where the tract homes were being built everywhere with the two bedrooms, the door that opened to the living room, and the garage for a single car. So the first Las Vegas was very modest, but my research, I found a lot of my books have used research, and one source just leads to another. For Vegas, the photographic archives at UNLV were very helpful, and they have pictures of the earliest showgirls, the earliest showroom stages, the oldest hotels, and all the figures within it. And after a while of researching, you start to enter that world. When I was writing about Imperial Russia, at first I thought I would never sort out all of the characters of the Tsar's family, and then it got to the point where I could note if a character had been misidentified in a photograph. So after a while, you just become steeped in the material, and it becomes your material.
So I did, huge research about Rio at that time. It started in 40s and goes to 50s and 60s. And I feel that I have a very fortunate place to write right now because we live here in California and I write about Brazil. And it's very good when you can write about something, some place from distance. I don't know if you guys have this experience. So I feel that I can see my country in a better way from the distance. And this is huge research. And I also think that the fact that I write books about the past and about Brazil, I just did the second book. It's kind of the same, you know. I also, it's related to the past. It's also my way of not disappearing in another culture. So I like to write in Portuguese, and I like to write about things that happen in Brazil, and I like to write about Brazil's past. I think that you have very few compared to the United States that, I mean, I am American, I could write about the United States, but I think there are so many, it's such a fortunate country. I have so many writers already doing this, and in Brazil you have so few, like, reading, addressing our past. So, the research was a big part of it. It was also a way to be connected to my own country.
Anybody else want to talk about research, or no? Okay.
I also sort of disappeared into the research. I mean, I had to read most of the writers, the narrator reads in order to understand.
Which is a tall order.
Yeah, in order to understand how her mind works. But the funnest part about the research was actually I was lucky enough to get a Fulbright to do background research in Catalonia. And I actually went on a series of walks that then are represented in the novel as literary pilgrimages, where I decided to grab a bunch of novels written by Catalan writers who eventually went into exile and use them as maps to navigate the space. And I didn't use any technology at all. So I was just looking at the descriptions of the landscape in the novels and then trying to walk the same paths. And so often I would have to cross railroad tracks and find the old roads and, you know, got lost a lot and had a lot of fun at the same time. So in a sense, you know, walking is a really big part of this novel, sort of the relationship between walking and thinking. And so in some ways, I kind of walked the book before I wrote it. And that was, you know, it feels extraordinary to me to have had that kind of really physical experience of the research.
When you talk about walking and maps, Rebecca Solnit's name pops into
yeah,
my mind.
Yeah, so, I love her writing. Yeah.
I'm glad to be reminded. All of your characters, of course, enter into relationships in the course of these novels, family relationships, relationships with men. I want to explore the idea of how relationships can subvert a woman's strength and how that occurs to you in terms of your novels and your characters.
Sure. Well, my main character, Alita, she meets a guy in college that she ends up staying with and marrying, and he's a really nice guy, and that was really important for me because a big part of why she gives up, she wants to be a writer, and a big part of why she gives up her dream of being a writer is because she follows him trying to support his career, and she does it willingly. And I think that's, or seemingly willingly, I guess it's the kind of thing you have to kind of parse apart and say, well, is she willing in the fact that she, you know, I'm kind of questioning the idea of why women get so much happiness and self-worth and fulfillment or some type of fulfillment that I don't think men tend to get from their relationships. It means a lot, I think, for women, and I'm not immune to this. I mean, I know how good it felt when I had my first boyfriend, how that changed the way I perceived myself. I thought I was, like, way in a better place. And I think that that's something, I mean, I'm kind of obsessed with that idea, why that means so much to us and why, because of course men, it feels good to them too to have someone in their life that loves them and that they love, but I don't think that they gain self-worth from it in the same way. I mean, you see it all the time with, you know, you'll meet a friend who's like amazing and she's brilliant and she's like the kindest girl and she'll like do anything and gorgeous and all these amazing qualities and she'll date some horrible guy and you're like, why are you doing this? And usually the answer is very complicated that she couldn't even tell you, you know. She would rather... Right, exactly. There's someone like that in my book who dates somebody absolutely awful and stays with him despite some of the horrible things he's doing. And... you know, that's a complicated thing for us. And that's why, for me, it was so important to have her relationship be a good relationship. Because obviously, if it was a bad relationship, it's like, well, why don't you just leave? You know, that could be kind of your question throughout the book. But seeing someone give up their dreams for someone who's wonderful and a great love in their life, you know, I think that many people would be tempted to do that or would do that and do that. I mean, it's very complicated. So that's what I was kind of thinking with that.
That's something that's so extraordinary about your book, that without, because you said it, so spoiler alert, but she doesn't go back to writing, but there's a particularly poignant scene that I'm remembering where she's with her child, and she thinks, this is exactly where I want to be and what I want to be doing, not what you've read 1,000 times before, oh, if only I were writing. And I so appreciate that because we come to know her and we get it. So that's really cool. Anybody else on relationships and your characters? And Ezarine, I'm thinking of your character and her love affair. And does that thwart her, do you think?
I mean, it's probably the opposite end of the spectrum from what you were describing, because she doesn't, her writing and thinking and reading is of utmost importance. And it's been that way for me as a person, too. And, you know, eventually, she does understand what's at stake with Ludo, but in a much more kind of, I think, it's not so much about him as it is about her understanding of what how complicated the relationship is between love and exile. And she comes to understand that the greatest revenge she can actually enact on social disorder and entropy is actually to learn to love. And but it's not just in the romantic sense, you know, because she's not necessarily convinced for the course of the novel that life is worth living, and that gets examined, but it's a very kind of slow, meticulous, and difficult process. She's not a character who is very all that interested in relationships or in men. She seems, you know, pretty self-sufficient. But
she makes it really hard for him.
Yeah, you know, I left all her teeth in her, and that's the only way that I could write a character like that, right? Someone who has lived in all these different worlds, whose identity is complex and moving and kaleidoscopic and really shattered. And if I had to take great care in how she might change, what aspects of her could change, and what hope means in the novel, so that it wasn't a redemptive arc. So, yeah.
My character is a young woman who becomes involved with an older predatory man, as often happens in Las Vegas. Her first involvement is with Ben Siegel. She thinks he's being a father figure toward her. Every time he comes back from L.A. to the Flamingo building site, he's bringing her a lipstick, or he's bringing her a dress or a pair of high-heeled shoes. He's murdered before she can grow up enough for him to take her, but her next involvement is with a fictional mobster I created. And after their first encounter together in the bedroom, she realizes that is what Ben Siegel was grooming me for, the way a pedophile will groom a victim, because she was young enough not to see it. The only way she can escape from this predatory and powerful older man without losing the gains that she's made is by hurting herself. And when he sees her hurting herself, he pulls away, but he doesn't ever entirely let go, and she ultimately is going to have to leave Las Vegas if she's going to leave him behind.
Going outside my book a little bit, I think it was Neil Gaiman who said that one of his writing tips is marry well, and or not marry at all, right? And yeah, I think that relationships are very important for, you know, any kind of accomplishment in life. And in my book, the protagonist, she's married with this, you know, he's just a good provider, and he gives her everything, like the house, the middle class life, and she wants more. And in the end, something happened that I think it's very interesting, because it's similar a little bit with your protagonist, is that she ended up locking herself in her own life and with her books and with doing her writing, because they became so different and so distant. But she became so different from different from her husband, and I think that it was, the book was made in a time in Brazil that not marrying was not an option, and you couldn't really choose that much, and that's the way people would grow old, like sometimes being distant from one another.
It occurs to me, and I don't know if you've read each other's books, but your two characters, Martha's and Azarine's, are so very different, and your character has to live out what she wants very quietly and secretly, whereas your character is doing it out loud all the time, every day. They're really a contrast, but they're both extraordinarily accomplished people in their own ways. Yeah. I don't know if any of you have read Meg Wolitzer's new book, The Female Persuasion. Anybody? She, and I don't know if any of you have, but I just finished it and loved it. And she, in the book, talks a lot about, for a coming-of-age feminist, the role of a mentor and what that means and how important that is. So I wonder if you, any of you want to take on that idea about the role of a literary mentor or a feminist mentor or a female character who's made a big difference in your writing life.
Well, I think of, when you say that, I definitely think of my own mentors. And I would say that the two people I would consider mentors are both women. And actually, I had kind of an unusual background because I became ill in high school with an autoimmune illness, which forced me to drop out of high school. And I was very sick for a while. And then I went to, when I finally got well, there wasn't really a lot of options for me to graduate high school. I got a GED, and I went to community college for about a year and a half before moving on to Emerson College and then moving on to Oxford. So I really got back on track where I wanted to be, where I saw myself. But that kind of, turn is definitely unexpected and hard. And the two people that I consider mentors are both professors that I met at community college. And I would say they're both women, but I would say the defining characteristic of them really is their kindness. I don't think we talk a lot about kindness and empathy in the way, in general, and how much of a big part of success that is as a person, to be kind and to have empathy and to be able to touch people and make them feel connected in the world, which is, we're all living our little lonely lives together, so it's nice to have that kind of connection. And I mean, they saw my talent and my ambitions, and they definitely fostered that. But I think it was more than that. I think it was just someone treating me kindly and helping out because they were good people. And I think that's a huge part of mentorship. And it's a connective tissue. It's part of feminism. It should be part of feminism because that's what it is. It's an empathy. Equality is about empathy. And so, yeah, I would say that is really what stands out for me. But
Before all of you comment on mentors, I just have to point out the fact that this is rare is so crazy. Here's a woman who wrote a book about somebody who marries a nice guy, and she's talking about kindness. I just want to say that because that's something we don't get a whole lot of, and it's really great. Thank you. Thank you.
Okay. Can I speak? Because I'm a community college teacher myself, and so I really do make it, kind of my business to mentor and encourage and be as kind as I possibly can, because the students who feed into a community college often have things in their lives that have derailed them, whether it's poverty or illness or distress of some kind. And regularly in my classroom, students are missing classes because they have court dates or a family member died in Mexico and they've been going back and forth to deal with that, or they have children that they're trying to take care of. And so I think kindness is the most important part of mentorship. I just finished teaching Margaret Edson's play Wit, in which the central character, Vivian Baring, is a scholar of 17th century poetry. Her holds herself to high standards, and by the end of her battle with cancer, realizes she's lived her life not the way she should have, that more important than being the smartest person in the room is being the kindest person in the room.
Yeah, may I just add to that for a moment, which is, when I think community college is kind of, it's really sad because it's so stigmatized, I think, in our culture. I know when I was in that position getting a GED and going to community college, I felt a sense of shame over it. And the second I was there, it was like, this is amazing. I met so many wonderful people and so many professors that cared. But also, I just wanted to say that it was such a huge part of me as a writer, I think, is the fact that I got to learn around people who were actually diverse, and diverse economically, diverse in their lives, diverse in their struggles. And, as I went on to Emerson College, which is a private institution, and then Oxford, it became narrower and narrower, the type of people. And especially with studying writing, and this is something that really gets to me, and you're going to see it more and more with art, with the cost of living rising, is that more and more of the same people with the same socioeconomic backgrounds are writing, and less, and we're getting less diversity on that level, and so we're getting less diverse stories. We're getting less of a breadth of our culture. And when you're in the school, I mean, you hear, people get scholarships, they're going to these schools. When you're actually there, you see that isn't, overall, it's the same kinds of kids getting to go have those opportunities, and it is such a shame.
Yes. Martha, do you want to say something about that?
I think that happens a lot, I think, in Brazilian literature as well. Yeah. And also, like, a lot of the protagonists, they just did the research recently, and the protagonist is always the white male, middle class, living in a big city. That's, That kind of protagonist and everything, it's all the same. It's a big movement in Brazil right now to trying to change that, to trying to hear to other voices. But at the same point, the problem is that people who has the education to do the writing and have the resources to do the writing, you know, are from the big cities and are middle class or high class. So that's the catch.
Do you have any mentors that you want to talk about, Martha?
I could say, like, I was raised in a very strict Catholic school. And I think the nuns did a great job because they were very disciplined, and they taught me that I carry this discipline with me to this day. And I just had to do this huge amount of exercises in Portuguese and also kindness. I was thinking about that because I was going to just say the discipline, but I think kindness too. I learned with them. Yeah.
Yeah, I was really lucky with mentors, especially in creative writing workshop as an undergraduate, where I was just writing these bizarre stories, and I was in class, you know, in the UC system, and it wasn't necessarily a very diverse classroom, and you know, I would get attacked a lot, and that happened also when I did my MFA at Brown, and
What do you mean attacked? What do you mean?
One student said, well, who does she think she is, the next Borges? And the professor, Michelle Latulé, who's a beautiful writer, said, well, how do you know she isn't? And I had the New York Times book review come out on this book just a couple of weeks ago, and they compared it to Borges, and I thought, I've waited. I've only waited 17 years for this moment. So that was really touching in a very private way. I also had an incredible mentor, Jaime Concha, who was Chilean, as an undergraduate at UCSD, and he was living in exile, quite lonely, and you know, we spent a lot of time together, and he taught me to read the great Latin American books. And I think most importantly, though, my mom. She's a very sort of eccentric but sophisticated woman who's very stubborn, and she paid a really high cost for being herself in our culture, and you know, we had to move around a lot, and I think that it kind of charged me with a sense of responsibility to always be exactly what I would like to be in any given moment, without necessarily feeling apologetic about it. And I think that for her, it came with a lot of struggle, because, you know, she came from a family, she had to get married, she couldn't live her life as an artist, and she was always very strict, but she was very supportive of my writing, and that she's probably my first mentor. Yeah.
You talked about the great Latin American books, and I'm sure there's a handful of names that most of us know here in this country, but I'd love for you to throw out a couple of names that we should read that we might not know.
Well, Clarice Lispector, Ukrainian writer from Brazil, Mario Vargas Llosa, who just has a book out recently that's actually about the Dominican Republic. And one of my greatest favorites is Carlos Fuentes, who has a beautiful big, thick book, but super readable, called, the translation is Where the Air is Clear. And it's just absolutely gorgeous.
Great. I was going to ask you, and I think I'll throw it out there anyway, but with a addendum, I was going to ask you about, having all written these strong female characters, how you read the classics, because Jane Eyre, of course, is referred to in the title of this panel. How you read the classics, if you want to talk about any one in particular and the way you read it today, but also books that you think it would behoove us all to read that you love, that have strong female characters that recommend themselves to you. So,
yeah. Well, my favorite book is Anna Karenina, and I got that when I was 17 from my mom as a gift, and I just love that book, and I don't really have like anything brilliant to say about it, except that it's really good. It's not that hard to read, even though it is so long. Tolstoy is actually really readable. Another book that I love, and that I love the heroine in, or the protagonist in, is The House of Mirth. And I mean, she's like great. She just like loves jewelry and like wants to be rich, but like does not want to marry a rich guy. And I mean, that was, you don't often see like, and even now you would rarely see a female character who's just like, you know what, I love money, I like nice things, and I want to like get these things. But at the time, that was kind of revolutionary because women couldn't just make their own money. If they wanted to be rich and they wanted to set their sights on that kind of success, there weren't choices to do that. And so that's really what so much of that book is about. So I very strongly would say read that book because it's fantastic.
I think that was growing up, a character that really stayed with me for a long time was, her name was Mafalda. She was from a comic strip made by Kino in Argentina. And it was a six-year-old girl growing up. It was made in the 60s and 70s. And she would discuss things like Cold War and communism. And she wouldn't be afraid of make these questions. And I just loved her so much. And regarding reading the classics, something that bothers me a little bit, and I think that tells a lot about the role of the woman, you know, in history, is how the female characters, the author always have to kill them. Like, you got Anna Karenina, you know. And then you have Madame Bovary, and then you have Machado de Assis in Brazil. All these strong female characters that I love, the author has to kill them. And he's not being mean, it's just that I think that for the book, for the story to make sense, you can't have a strong woman character and just make her be fulfilling and have a happy life and a happy ending. It's just, it was not possible, I think, in this kind of books. And I think that's very, quite interesting and tells a lot about our, you know, our world. And it's interesting because I just had to talk about that in an interview in Brazil, and they told, well, what kind of protagonist you'd like to see? And I think I would like to see protagonists more like Eat, Pray, Love, because Elizabeth Gilda, you know, she's not afraid of getting fat. She just traveled the world, and then she finds love. And I think it was a nice book, and it's very hard to find protagonists like this, you know, in fiction and nonfiction. So that's, and when you have more books like these, I think the world will be a better place. when you're able to write more books like this.
I'm a big reader of history, and so the book I'm reading right now that I love is Prairie Fires, and it's the biography of Laura Ingalls Wilder, you know, who wrote all those marvelous books in which she tried to capture the American experience in the late 1800s, and it was so difficult for women until the very sort of the turn of the century, when women couldn't own any property or any land or any homes. But the women took these sojourns alongside their men with their families, just constantly, restlessly searching for arable land all over Missouri and Nebraska and the Dakota Territory. And women in these small log cabins going crazy from lack of social interaction and the illnesses that they suffered, the children that they bore and then buried and then had to leave behind as they moved to the next acreage they were going to try to farm. So it's really a book about strength and also a book about delayed artistic achievements, and she didn't begin writing until the second half of her life and spent most of the first of it simply trying to subsist. Oh, you get your own.
A book that I love, and I would love to recommend, is by Marilyn Robinson called Housekeeping. It's her first book, and it's about just these extraordinary women who are all very, very strange, and they just sort of live these wild lives, and it goes through multiple generations, and it's just haunting and lyrical. And about the classics, I actually want to say, you know, I read quite a few, but there's always so many more to read. And one thing that I realize is that there's like a culture of intimidation around the classics and feeling like we can't just read them or that you have to have all this other knowledge to read them. And I don't think that's true at all. And coming back to this question of like being smart, being kind, it's not a binary. Like kindness is a deep form of intelligence. And it's important, I think, to remember that the classics were written by really big weirdos who were total misfits. And they were total outsiders. And they're really funny and ridiculous and also smart because they're very troubled and they're trying to figure out what it means to be human. And I really think that anyone can pick up any book. If they're looking for something and that book is kind of addressing those questions, those deep questions, it'll speak to you. And it doesn't matter if we don't understand every sentence. You know, it matters to like inhabit the experience and something, there will be some attrition, something will stick.
Just a note, I have to say, reading the classics changes over time too. You might read Madame Bovary one way when you're 30, and I can say definitely another way when you're 60. So I would love for you all, now that you've heard a little bit from this extraordinary panel of women who've written wonderful books, very different books, different perspectives, different characters. I would love for you all to get involved in the conversation. Please don't be shy, because I know there's something you want to ask. So if you'll just put your hand up, and our friend here with the microphone will come to you, and I see...
We're going to actually ask if you'd make a line over here.
Oh, okay. That's a good idea. Go ahead.
Hi, thank you so much. I guess my question is, are there any general like pitfalls or do's or don'ts or like easy, like even the idea of how many female characters are killed in the story? Are there any other like, you know, just like stereotypical ways that women are often written about and like kind of almost like a watch out for these tropes for other writers?
I don't think you should watch out for anything while you're writing. You should definitely do what feels right to you and don't, you know, think too hard about it. That's probably the first bit of advice I would ever give anyone, is to just kind of not be worried about doing the same thing other people are doing. I one time was in a workshop and there was this girl who was like, I hate when people say cliche, because if that's what it's like, then that's what it's like. And I thought, yeah, there's truth to that. So yeah, don't feel like you have to do you have to do that. You know, I think with my book, I wanted to write, you know, I had, Barbara was saying about the character and embracing motherhood. You don't see a lot of that in fiction, which is kind of funny. You see so many literary heroines who are completely hate motherhood and feel like it's completely oppressive, and that is so necessary. We need those voices, but you don't often hear the other side of it. Or I wrote about mother-daughter relationship that isn't riddled with conflict and isn't like a million times complicated, and they like hate each other and like they're friends and they like to go out to eat together. Like that's what that relationship is like. Yeah, exactly. It gets better. And it's just, so I kind of wanted to see things I hadn't seen. I think Toni Morrison once said, like, she always would write the book that she wanted to read. And that's what you should do. You should write exactly the book you want to read and not worry about what anyone else wants to read.
Hi. So you guys talked about how the Me Too movement isn't necessarily in the same place for everybody. But I wanted you guys to talk a little bit more about how, and this has been brought up in multiple articles by various reporters, that a lot of women of color, a lot of trans women, a lot of lesbians, a lot of poor women are not able to speak out. Sorry. And I just wanted to ask you guys, like, what do you think about that? And also, Adrian, you brought up your protagonist, how she uses men for for their money. If you could talk about maybe sex work in general and how they're left out of the Me Too movement, sex workers, female sex workers. Yeah.
I'm not sure I can answer to that. My character did recognize that men hold all the power, and that her only way to get any kind of foothold in the entertainment business in Vegas was to use the scaffolding of these men to climb on. I've already forgotten the other part of your question. There are a lot of sex workers in Las Vegas, as we know, and at various times it's been legalized and then delegalized or pushed in the corner. When we were first going to Vegas, they would be flipping out cards, giving to everybody about calling your escort service. That no longer is the case. And, of course, we've just had part of Steve Wynn with the Me Too movement, and he's not the only man in Vegas who's being accused or having to reconsider his behavior.
Azarine? Sure.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah, I think it's such an important question you're asking, and I know for myself, I am a U.S. citizen, but also an immigrant in this country, and speaking up means there's so many more internal challenges that I have to navigate. Or if someone else is financially dependent on you, or you're sponsoring someone's green card, or you know, there's sort of, in order to be able to get to the place where you can also speak up, you have to navigate the legacy of the patriarchal cultures and matriarchal cultures you were raised in, right? So it's not just this really easy, simple thing. And I recently, when there was the Muslim ban, I just to kind of as an example, I went to, my friends were all making posters and going down to protests, and I, you know, my husband was encouraging me to go participate. And the second I got there and I saw everyone protesting, I just started sobbing and had to leave because they were so excited to be there, and they were just like really, you know, proud of themselves, and they should be, of protesting and like making the posters, and they were all smiling and marching and chanting, and I just thought, I'm not in that place. Like this has real implications for me. And so that raises really difficult ethical questions, I think, about social responsibility. And, you know, I still don't really fully understand, like, is it better for my friends who can to be kind of speaking up on my behalf or on behalf of my family or other people who are struggling with those issues? Or should I be pushing myself to partake so that my voice isn't being co-opted in the process? I think there are so many ethical and emotional details that we're not really talking about in the Me Too movement, because they're so hard to parse and they're even scary to articulate, because we're also living in a culture where we're just afraid to say the wrong thing, which means that we're not having conversations because we're gonna say the wrong thing in the process of figuring out what's right. And I don't think there's great space for that right now, unfortunately.
Is it uncomfortable for you to address some of the conversations you think we need to be having?
It's not uncomfortable for me, but it's painful and difficult. It's not uncomfortable to the point where I won't have them, but I had to get to a certain place in order to be able to have them. And part of it is just having this book out in the world and having people embrace it shifted my emotional compass completely. It was a huge relief, but then again, because I'm someone who thinks a lot about civic responsibility, it allowed me, that relief and the love that the book has received kind of transferred over onto me and allowed me to be more honest about certain things. But I'm, you know, yeah, it's painful. It's a painful conversation for all of us, I think.
Yeah, I just want to say too, I think we have to, what I brought up before about writers and kind of this narrowing of the socioeconomic level of the voices we're hearing, that goes across the entire board. You know, people that are being able, which has really changed, because you used to hear about the starving artist and people could make livings for themselves and be writers in certain respects. That's changed so much, and you see more and more, again, people who are at the top who are the writers. They're the journalists. They're the ones writing the blogs. They're the ones doing a lot of the writing. And so that's part of the reason I think that the movement leaves out so many voices, is that we do have this big socioeconomic divide in our country. And if you're having all the people, the writers, who many of whom live in very bubbly worlds, they're not even a part of those worlds. They don't even have any kind of connection to them. Their families don't. So to me, that's another element of it that I don't think we think about as much. But yeah, that's a part of it.
Yeah, I'm just to show how the Me Too movement is it's hard to discuss that in, if you think about the word. Just to tell you a story about my family, we have, like, my parents, they have a house in Rio, and we receive refugees from, you know, other countries that are going to Brazil, and they just need a place when they are going to be a couple of months there while, you know, they start their new life. So we have people from Congo now and Venezuela. So we received this family from Congo, and it was the mom and the daughter and the brother. And the father had been killed in Congo, and they stayed there for a while, and then they went she found a job, and they went to find a house for them, and it was in a slum. And then they had to come back to the house. The girl was 9 years old, and it was this beautiful black girl, because they are really black, like you don't see more like black people like that in Brazil, because you're all mixed. And then she was like this beautiful, pure black. And then the drug dealer in the slum wanted her for her girlfriend, and she was 9 years old. So, and then how can we address, when you are aware of other cultures, how can I explain the Me Too movement for this mother or this daughter? You know, it's so far from the reality. So that's I think this is the kind of thing that you should address. That's why I think that's a feminism. We should discuss inequality in the world so that you can discuss all of it.
Well, if there aren't any other questions, I just want to say for me, this panel went somewhere that I didn't even know it was going to go, which is the very best thing that could possibly happen. So I'm delighted to have met you all and to have you here with your books. I want to remind you that all of these spectacular women will be signing copies of their book in the lobby. And Azarine and Adrian and Martha and Yana, thank you so much. And thanks so much to all of you for coming.
We hope you enjoyed this podcast from the 2018 Bay Area Book Festival. For more podcasts, please go to www.baybookfest.org.